to the headlines. Informed sources say that Israeli weapons were used in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Russia and China joined the chorus of countries that condemned the assassination of Iran's prominent nuclear scientist. And the European Union and the UK remain highly divided in their crunch Brexit talks, while Germany says the bloc does not need a deal with Britain at any price. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Informed sources say that Israeli weapons were used in the assassination of nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The sources say remnants of Israeli-made weapons were found at the site of the incident. The report comes as Iranian officials have already announced that traces of the Israeli regime's involvement were found in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh. Earlier, the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said that Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a new type of complex operation. He said electronic equipment was used to carry out the assassination, and no one was present at the scene. Shamkhani said the Zionist regime committed the murder with involvement of MKO terrorists. Iran has held a funeral ceremony for newly assassinated nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in Tehran. Participating senior military officials once again vowed harsh revenge against the main perpetrators, Saman Kujuri reports.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Minister's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Russia joins the chorus in condemning the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, calling it a terrorist act. In a statement, the Russian Foreign Ministry expressed concern over what it called the provocative nature of the move. The statement said the killing is clearly aimed at destabilizing and building up potential conflict in the region. The Kuwaiti Foreign Ministry also denounced the assassination of Iranian scientists. In a statement, Lebanon's Foreign Ministry also condemned the assassination, calling for restraint. China also slammed the killing as a violent crime.
We are shocked by the assassination and death of the Iranian scientist. The Chinese side condemns the violent crime and urges thorough investigation into it.
Foreign Ministry spokeswoman also said that Beijing opposes any act that may aggravate regional tensions and undermine regional peace and stability. Chunying urged all parties to cooperate and ease regional tensions. The Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein slammed the killing as an act that does not contribute to supporting stability. The European Union blasted the killing as a criminal act, while Turkey called it an act of terror. Journalist and commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas says U.S. President Donald Trump wants to get away with murders before his term ends in January.
Well, firstly, the Trump presidency obviously is coming to an end. He seems to be conceding. So there's a lot of speculation that in the last month or so, he can basically get away with murder. He has got away with murder already. We know what happened to General Soleimani, for instance, on a diplomatic mission in pure daylight. They assassinated an Iranian official. The same forces have essentially done this on Iranian soil now with the scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Whether they deny it or not is irrelevant. The fact is the deep state exists in order to create scenarios, to create situations where war or certain political engineering can be executed in the interests of the Western imperialists. Now, of course, the ramifications for the area are the same as they've been for many decades now. Ever since the Islamic Revolution has come onto the scene, it's been a game changer, and the ramifications, primarily for the illegal state of Israel, are its absolute termination.
Reports say the European Union and the UK remain highly divided as time is running out to reach a Brexit trade deal. The source for the bloc said the weekend negotiations have been difficult and massive divergences are still in place. The source said the differences include fisheries, state aid, and dispute settling procedures. Irish Foreign Minister Simon Coveney has also said two big issues remain unresolved. He urged the UK and the EU to avoid engaging in a blame game, warning the time was running out. The European Union and the UK started a fresh round of talks in London on Saturday after breaking multiple deadlines. Britain's transitional EU exit agreement is set to expire on December 31st, however. So far, they have failed to reach an agreement. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has declined to rule out a new vote for independence from Britain next year. Sturgeon says that she wants to see a referendum held in the early part of the next term of the new Scottish Parliament. She warned that she may go to court for permission to hold a referendum if London tries to block it. Scotland's parliamentary election is due in May 2021, and Sturgeon's National Party is expected to mandate a new independence referendum. Back in 2014, Scots voted against independence. However, Brexit and the British government's handling of the COVID-19 crisis have resulted in a new wave to push for independence from the UK. Most opinion polls show a majority now favor secession. Our correspondent from London, Saeed Pourezzo, joins us. We also have Tommy Sheridan, a former member of the Scottish Parliament with the Socialist Party and founder of the independence group Hope Over Fear, who joins us from Glasgow. Okay, Saeed, first over to you. Give us the latest that you have on this story.
The word on the ground, Kaveh, is that the Scottish independence has never been so popular, and that the very existence of this union of England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland, of the United Kingdom, has never been so vulnerable. And that's what's at stake with these consecutive polls that you also briefly mentioned, conducted by the likes of YouGov, Ipsos, and others, that have found that support for the Scottish independence is in the lead. These are the numbers they have come up with are the highest that have ever been recorded, and it is something that has to be taken very seriously. It is also being called as a warning to Westminster, to number 10 Downing Street, that is very serious, that they have to take it very seriously, that Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, is winning the so-called argument. And the message to the British Prime Minister seems to be clear, that these polls are really speaking for themselves. There have also been polls on the popularity of Nicola Sturgeon and the popularity of the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and how they have been handling the COVID situation, the pandemic, and the numbers really are self-explanatory. The question that folks in Scotland have been answering in those polls is the same question that was put to them in 2014. Should Scotland be independent? Excluding those who said don't know, 58% have said yes, compared to the 42% who responded in the negative, which is a record high number compared to 2014, where the first referendum was held. But people are saying, you know what, polls do not bring you independence. What is going to happen is Nicola Sturgeon, in the May parliamentary elections, will have to secure a majority. Even if she doesn't, some are saying, she will probably be helped by the Greens, pro-independence party, to get her over the line, to get that mandate that she needs to call number 10 Downing Street and tell them, I have the mandate, now I need your approval, your green light, to hold a second referendum to break away from the UK. Cover.
So, Tommy Sheridan, should Scotland vote for secession, vote for independence?
Absolutely, and it's important to add to what your correspondent in London has already said. The unprecedented nature of the opinion polls should not in any way be underestimated. There have now been 14 successive opinion polls indicating the majority of Scots want independence. The support for independence in those polls among young people, those under the age of 35, is over 77%. This is a movement whose day is coming. The truth is, we are already halfway out of the British Union. Britain, per se, is dying. All that has to be arranged now is the funeral. Because once Scotland has its independence, I don't think Ireland will be far behind us in relation to unity of that island at long last. We have now momentum behind us. And all of those polls which I have just mentioned, all of them, indicate the SNP will not just win the May elections next year, they will win those elections with a romping majority. That means independence next year will be on the agenda. The only criticism I have of the SNP is that they're dragging their feet in calling the referendum. We talk about mandates. It's very important. Just this final point. The mandate for Indate Ref 2 will not appear next May. It already exists. The SNP won the 2015 general election, 2017 general election, 2019 general election, and the 2016 Scottish Parliament election. All of those victories were mandates for Indate Ref 2. The Scottish Parliament has voted twice to hold Indate Ref 2. So the mandate exists. All that will happen next May is there will be a reinforcement of the existing mandate. And the appeal I have, Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP, is get on with it and let's get out of this sinking disaster, which is Boris's Britain.
Okay. All right. So, Saeed, what Tommy Sheridan there said, obviously, many dimensions. I wish we could discuss it further. But quickly, if you can, not familiar with the rules. I'm guessing there are some out there who aren't either. And that is if Nicola Sturgeon comes and tells 10 Downing Street, we want to go for the secession. Can Downing Street prevent this from happening?
Well, one thing that she has been asked to do is to sort of go ahead and say that they're going to hold a referendum and wait for Downing Street to respond, to legally challenge it. Now, whether or not they can do it, they probably can. I'm not very well-versed on British law at the moment, but I am aware that she's getting calls from different quarters of the different political parties who are pro-independent in Scotland, calling on her to have a plan B, have some sort of a strategy to move forward if and she continues
Let me ask Tom Sheridan that question. Can 10 Downing Street prevent Nicola Sturgeon's drive for secession, if that happens?
That question depends on which lawyer you ask. You see, the 1707 Act of the Union was a voluntary act. It is not part of a written constitution. There is not a rule in that voluntary union which says that you can never leave. This isn't the Hotel California that you can check out any time but never leave. We have to say quite clearly that, of course, as a sovereign nation, Scotland was sovereign for hundreds of years before we joined the Act of Union of 1707. Of course we have the right to self-determination. And that's what should be put to the test. We don't need permission. How dare Westminster say that we need permission in order to get our independence?
Okay.
We're an adult nation. We're a mature nation. We'll take our own decisions.
All right.
We will politely inform Westminster, but we don't ask permission.
Thank you for that. Very enthusiastic, Tommy Sheridan. We do appreciate all that information and your comments. And Saipur, as always, thank you for giving us an update on this. And that does it for the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. In Sudan, flags are flying at half staff after former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi died of COVID-19 at the age of 84. He was a leading political figure in Sudan who was well known for his anti-Israeli policies. From Khartoum, Muhammad Ali Fazari has more.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. It will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
The Imam Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this is era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature, and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not Al Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi in the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was an icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Muhammad Fazari, from Khartoum, Sudan, city of Omdurman.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It's unlikely that Joe Biden will ever reverse Pompeo's stigmatization of anti-Israel BDS campaign upon assuming office. He's more likely to support the Zionist regime and its illegal settlements in the West Bank. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, which is published under the heading U.S. Republican-Democrat Assault on BDS Campaign is Systematic. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said the State Department will consider the anti-Zionist BDS campaign anti-Semitic and withdraw U.S. government support from organizations engaged in such hateful BDS conduct, calling the boycott, divestment, and sanctions push a cancer and vowing to stand with like-minded nations on the issue. Pompeo stood beside the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he also directed the State Department's envoy on combating anti-Semitism to identify organizations that engage in or otherwise support the global BDS campaign. The BDS movement promotes boycotts and sanctions against the Zionist regime through various avenues. The aim is to end the Zionist regime's occupation of East Al-Quds, Gaza, and the Golan Heights, achieve equal rights for Palestinians, and return Palestinian refugees to the Holy Land. The designation of BDS as anti-Semitic is intended to silence the Zionist regime's critics, making supporters of Palestinian rights wary of engaging in public debate. It also seeks to make any debate even more fraught, with defenders of the Zionist regime policy emboldened to declare opponents who advocate any material pressure on Israel anti-Semitic. In the prevailing environment, don't expect Joe Biden to reverse the new policy. In addition to the clear statements made by Joe Biden and his pick for the post of State Secretary about their unconditional support for the Zionist regime and Washington's unimpeded military and financial aid to Tel Aviv during his term, Biden has never responded to Pompeo's policy, and it seems unlikely that he will. It's unlikely that Biden will ever reverse Pompeo's stigmatization of BDS upon assuming office. He is more likely to support the Zionist regime and its illegal settlements in the West Bank. This is because AIPAC is also behind Pompeo's attack on the anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. Both the American Republican and Democratic parties are critical to thwarting the anti-Israel BDS campaign. This will only make Biden silent on the matter, even though this goes against international law and their freedom of speech. This is why there are legal arguments for BDS by the United Nations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and many other groups that are all part of a global campaign to end the Zionist regime's occupation of Palestine. There is nothing illegitimate for this campaign or anti-Semitic about a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions in response to these crimes. Indeed, demanding or creating consequences for human rights violations or to create material pressure for changes in a policy that had caused so much bloodshed and misery for so long is lawful under international law. The new assault on the BDS movement is an assault on the fundamental norms of international law, and it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Those who claim that the Zionist regime should not be targeted with economic repercussions for its policies should defend that proposition on its merits. But any argument that boycotts against the Zionist regime are preemptively out of bounds is neither ethical nor credible. If the Zionist regime policies were justified, that argument should not be difficult to make without resorting to any effort to preempt the opposing viewpoint. Those who support the Zionist regime's illegal settlements are only prolonging the occupation of the regime in Palestine. Those that target the BDS movement only recognize the Zionist regime for the cancer that it is. Put simply, they are helping to recognize West Bank settlements as part of the occupied Palestine, even as most of the world views the move as a violation of international law. As mentioned earlier, the ongoing Republican-Democrat assault on BDS is a systematic assault on Palestine. It undermines international opposition to the Zionist regime occupation, colonization, and apartheid against Palestinians by calls for prolonging this regime on the one hand with anti-Palestinian racism on the other in order to suppress advocacy of Palestinian rights. This fraudulent policy should be condemned by the international civil society, including world authorities on human rights at the United Nations. Despite the new shenanigans by foreign policy establishment in Washington, the BDS movement for Palestinian freedom, justice, and equality is here to stay until all those struggling for a more dignified, just, and free Palestine succeed in holding the Zionist regime to account and end its apartheid and settler colonialism.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُو هُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Throughout the course of the previous evenings, we had the opportunity to look at the concept of injustice and justice with inspiration from Imam Hussein alayhi salam's mission and his struggle. And we've looked at it from many different angles, whether it be the interaction with people of injustice, whether it be trying to identify what is the greatest act of injustice, and other perspectives as well. When we talk about interaction with others, there's one time when we discuss what effect that interaction is going to have on us. And that's something that we had a chance to address in the previous night. But there's another perspective when you look and see how is it that you are supposed to interact with others? How can you influence others? And that's what I'd like to focus on this evening. And as a focal point for our discussion, I want to first quote a verse which is appears at the end of Surah An-Nahl. It's a verse that I'm sure all of the lovers of the Quran are familiar with. Allah Ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إن الله يأمر بالعدل والإحسان وإيتاء ذي القربى وينهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر والبغي يعظكم لعلكم تذكرون. Allah Ta'ala commands you to towards justice, and He commands you to have ihsan, and He commands you to take care of the near ones and the orphans, and to He prevents you from injustice, and He prevents you from sinfulness. Perhaps you may be amongst those who remember. And this verse contains some very, it's a wide-ranging verse, which gives us a very practical prescription, both on an individual level and on a societal level, of how Allah wants us to operate. But you could say that, to sum up, Allah in this verse tells us and commands us towards justice in everything that we do, and He prevents us and prohibits us from committing acts of injustice. And this verse was often quoted by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. For example, we're told in, according to reports, that when our Prophet used to recite his sermons, he would end by reciting this verse. It's kind of like a summation of everything else that he would like to convey to the people. What I'd like to do tonight is to focus on the first two parts of that, where Allah says, "Inna Allaha ya'amuru bil adli wal ihsan." Allah commands you towards justice and towards ihsan. A lot of times, ihsan is translated as doing good. So Allah commands you towards being just and doing good. But according to some of the commentaries of the Quran by some of the greatest commentators, they explain that ihsan is actually something which guides us how to interact with others on a superior level, in a way which is more fruitful than just on the level of justice. So let me explain what ihsan actually means, and then we'll talk about its relationship to justice, and then we'll talk about some of the applications of that in our lives. Allah Ta'ala, in many verses in the Quran, He mentions this concept of ihsan. And ihsan refers to doing something in the best way possible. In one of the ahadith reported from our Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, He says that try to do ihsan in everything that you do. Every single action that you perform, try to do it not just in a way where you're doing wajib and staying away from haram, or doing halal and staying away from haram, but do it with ihsan. And then He gives an example. He says that when you go and you take an animal to the slaughtering house and you're about to slaughter it, then before you do so, then make sure that you give the animal some water. Make sure that the instrument that you're going to be using to do the cutting, that you've sharpened that blade, so that when the cut is made, it is done in a swift way. Make sure that when you actually do that cut, that you do so in a way which is fast, right? Not something that is sort of delayed. Make sure that once you do it, that you don't move the corpse of the body, let the life exit it, and then you go ahead and you move it. Make sure that when you do it, then there is no other animal which can see this happening, nor can it see the other animals, and so on and so forth. All of those are present in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. They teach us that when you want to slaughter an animal, you think about all these other things as well too. You know, imagine, just as a side point, in today's economy of like mass production, when they want to do this type of thing, they build factories and they build like these conveyor belts, and they hang up the animals and they want to do it very fast, right? Do you think they have time to do this type of special things, like this type of ihsan? But this is what our Prophet calls us to do. Now, is it wajib to do these things? No. But it is something which leads to a higher level of operation. Like when you want to achieve this goal of having this animal, you and being able to have dinner and whatnot, then there's one way you do it, and you take it just a very okay. What I got to do? What's the basic sort of thing? And that time you look and see how can you make it be done in an excellent way. That same concept of doing things in an excellent way applies to everything else that we do as well. There's one famous hadith which is reported in both the books of hadith of the Ahlus Sunnah as well as the Shia as well, where Jibreel alayhi salam appears in the form of a human being, and he came to the Prophet and he asks him some questions. And of course this was in order for the people to learn. So one of the things he asks him is, what is the meaning of ihsan? Okay, and Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says to him, say salawat please. So he says to him that ihsan is for you to worship Allah as if you can see him. And if you cannot see him, then you should know that he sees you. Now I'm sure that you've heard this tradition narrated before. I wonder if we've gotten a chance to ponder upon it. It's something which is an extremely rich and very one of those ahadith which you can really, really take a lot from. In this hadith, there are at least two levels of awareness that are referred to, where somebody can reach and worship Allah at those levels. One of them is the level where it's as if they can see Allah Ta'ala. And another level is where they cannot, it's not as if they can see Allah, but they are aware that He is seeing them. And in that, there's something we can practically take, just as a side point, that when we get a chance, or when we can, when we have the opportunity to do so, when we're not so busy with other things, especially when we are worshiping Allah, let us just have this come to our minds, that we are in the presence of Allah. The entire world is in the presence of Allah. And that itself is a type of awareness which can really change the quality of everything that we do, especially the acts of worship that we perform. Now, going back to this topic of ihsan, here the Prophet is talking about worshiping, but it's a higher level of worship. It's a worship which has more quality to it. So one time you can talk about slaughtering an animal, and you can do so in a way where you're observing these extra etiquette, and that becomes like the most beautiful and excellent way of doing so. And there's another time where you're talking about the acts of worship and, you know, all those things that we do to strive to get closer to Allah. And the Prophet is saying that even worshipping as well, there's ihsan in that as well too. One time you talk about a level of just like, what's the bare minimum you need to do in order to get it correct. Another time you say, well, what if you want to actually have this be a source of elevation and proximity and spiritual cleansing? So that's when you talk about those type of things. Now, that same concept of ihsan is something that has been applied to the relationships that we have to other people, with other people. There's one time when you describe relationships on the level of huquq and rights and responsibilities, and you say that, okay, well, I'm in this relationship, this is the way that these are the rights that I have on you, and these are the rights you have on me. And we have to make sure that, you know, we're always fulfilling these rights. And if you are going to be somebody who goes against my rights, then I'm going to take you to account for that. Why? Because that's what justice calls for. Justice calls for rights to be observed, putting everything in its proper place, observing the rights. In a society, when you're trying to like run things in a way where there's order, there's system, right? You, when you have a government, when you have, like, let's say, you know, people's like property rights and, you know, companies and all that, you do need to have this type of approach where everything is like legal, you have rights and responsibility and whatnot.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir. روحي
كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A recount in Wisconsin's largest county demanded by President Donald Trump's election campaign ended on Friday, 27th of November, with the president-elect Joe Biden gaining votes. After a recount in Milwaukee County, Joe Biden made a net gain of 132 votes out of nearly 460,000 cast. Overall, the Democrat gained 257 votes to Donald Trump's 125. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at The Guardian, with contributions from Reuters and Associated Press news agencies. The piece is titled, "Joe Biden Gains Votes in Wisconsin County After Trump-Ordered Recount." Stay with us for more. A recount in Wisconsin's largest county demanded by President Donald Trump's election campaign ended on Friday, 27th of November, with the president-elect Joe Biden gaining votes. After a recount in Milwaukee County, Joe Biden made a net gain of 132 votes out of nearly 460,000 cast. Overall, the Democrat gained 257 votes to Donald Trump's 125. Trump's campaign had demanded recounts in two of Wisconsin's most populous and Democratic-leaning counties, after he lost Wisconsin to Joe Biden by more than 20,000 votes. The two recounts will cost the Trump campaign $3 million. Dane County is expected to finish its recount on Sunday. Overall, Biden won November's U.S. presidential election with 306 Electoral College votes, to Donald Trump's 232. Biden also leads by more than 6 million in the popular vote tally. After the recount ended, the Milwaukee County Clerk, George Christensen, said, "The recount demonstrates that what we already know, that elections in Milwaukee County are fair, transparent, accurate, and secure. The Trump campaign is still expected to mount a legal challenge to the overall result in Wisconsin, but time is running out. The state is due to certify its presidential result next Tuesday. On Friday, Trump's legal team suffered yet another defeat when a federal appeals court in Philadelphia rejected the campaign's latest effort to challenge the state's election results. Trump's lawyers said they would take the case to the Supreme Court despite the Philadelphia judge's assessment that the campaign's claims have no merit. Judge Stefanos Bibas wrote for the three-judge panel, "Free, fair elections are the lifeblood of our democracy. Charges of unfairness are serious, but calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations and then proof. We have neither here." President Trump continued to maintain without evidence that there was election fraud in the state, tweeting early on Saturday, "The 1,126,940 votes were created out of thin air. I won Pennsylvania by a lot, perhaps more than anyone will ever know." Meanwhile, Donald Trump's baseless claims of electoral fraud in Georgia are increasingly worrying his own party. Republicans are concerned that the chaos caused by Trump's stance and his false comments on the conduct of the election in the key swing state, which Joe Biden won, could hinder his party's efforts to retain control of the Senate. A runoff for Georgia's two Senate seats is scheduled for early January, and if the Democrats clinch both seats, it will give them control of the upper house as well as the House of Representatives. When asked about his previous baseless claims of fraud in Georgia during a Thanksgiving Day press conference, Donald Trump said he was very worried about them, saying, "You have a fraudulent system." He then called the state's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who has defended the state's election process, an enemy of the people. Such attacks have Republicans worried as they seek to motivate Georgia voters to come to the polls in early January, volunteer for their state Senate campaigns, and, perhaps more important than all, dig deep into their pockets to pay for the unexpected runoff races. In particular, Donald Trump's comments have spurred conspiracy theories that the state's electoral system is rigged and prompted some of his supporters to make calls for a boycott of the coming vote, something that local Georgia Republicans desperately do not want. His demonization of Georgia's entire electoral system is hurting his party's chances at keeping the Senate, warned an article published by the website Politico. Even President Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., has jumped into the fray in Georgia, tweeting, "I'm seeing a lot of talk from people that are supposed to be on our side telling GOP voters not to go out and vote. That is nonsense. Ignore those people." The president has also pledged to visit Georgia to hold rallies in support of the two Republican candidates, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. The first of those events is expected to be on Saturday, 5th of December, and could be a double-edged sword. Donald Trump is still a powerful force with loyal following whose endorsement is a key mobilization tool for the race. On the other hand, in his freewheeling rallies, Donald Trump may spout conspiracy theories that undermine their campaigns. Certainly, Trump's mood has become increasingly erratic even as he made the clearest signs yet that he will eventually leave the White House, which he convincingly lost to Joe Biden in both the popular vote and the vital electoral college that actually picks the next president. On Thanksgiving Day, Trump said he would leave the White House when the Electoral College voted for Joe Biden. He has so far defied tradition by refusing to concede defeat and launching legal attempts to challenge the outcome of election in battleground states, including Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. So far, those legal efforts have all failed. On Thursday, 26th of November, Trump had declined to say whether he would attend Joe Biden's inauguration, which is due to take place on 20th of January, and called one reporter a lightweight, telling him, "Don't talk to me like that." Trump continued his rant on Friday, 27th of November, producing a long string of retweets and tweets making untrue claims about election and his opponent. Trump tweeted, "Biden can only enter the White House as president if he can prove that his ridiculous 80 million votes were not fraudulently or illegally obtained."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kHz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. A new model for the presence of the people in the arena of Sacred Defense and the cultivation of talents.
One of the glorious acts behind the front lines was the decision of some people to stay in their cities, cities in Kurdistan, Khuzestan, and other provinces. Some people stayed in their cities while they were subject to the heavy and regular invasion of the enemy. The fourth point is that in the sacred defense era, the most exalted virtues showed themselves. Both moral virtues and spiritual transcendence were witnessed during the sacred defense. One cannot really find precedents like this. Of course, there are a few examples here and there, but witnessing it in such large and massive numbers is really unprecedented. I know no other arena like the sacred defense in which we witnessed such moral characteristics, both moral virtues and spiritual transcendence, religious qualities and the like. The biographies written indicate the existence of such qualities. The same is true of testaments and other writings about soldiers' sentiments. Sincerity, honesty, and warmth are examples of moral virtues.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Basically, the front lines were a place where you could easily see sincerity and warmth. Everyone had a friendly relationship with others. They had purity and worked for God. In that arena, some people practiced sincerity and showed their divine intentions in action. They also exhibited humility and a spirit of serving others. We have frequently read in biographies astonishing events narrated by soldiers. For example, such and such a battalion were sleeping in their tents, and when they woke up in the morning, they saw that all their boots had been polished. Who had polished them? It is not clear. After doing some research, it becomes clear that their commander had collected their boots and then polished them, or that he washed their dirty clothes, or that he had washed the toilets. These are astonishing events. Such was their humility and their spirit of rendering service, doing altruistic things and sacrificing themselves.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.